I'm Sarah Grass, and this is Hearsay from the Sidelines, a show about the place where law, sports, and culture intersect. Brought to you by Culture and Sports and Seton Hall Law School's Gaming, Hospitality, Entertainment, and Sports Law program. I know I promised a season two to the show, and I promise it's coming. But I wanted to first do an update to season one, which focused on the important topic of trans inclusion in youth sports, because there have been some significant updates to the cases and rulemaking discussed throughout the first season. I put this episode together with one of my amazing research assistants who worked over the summer on the background research for season two.
Hi, Emily. Thank you so much for being here. And do me a favor and just briefly introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Emily Radish. I'm a second-year student at Seton Hall Law School. I'm also Professor Grass's research assistant. And I grew up as a swimmer. I swam Division I for a year and then Division III for 3 years. So I'm really interested in sports. I also have an interest in healthcare, and that's a little bit about me and my legal interests.
So I appreciate that you are interested in this topic and that you were willing to do an update to season one. A lot has happened since I recorded the last episode of season one. Trans athletes were a huge issue during the most recent election, as you know, anyone who was awake during that period probably observed. And you know, these issues also came up during the Summer Olympics. And we want to talk about, you know, all of those things. So I'm going to kind of hand it over to you since you did the bulk of the research on this. So let's start actually by talking about the Soul v. Connecticut case, which is something that I focused on really heavily during season one of the podcast. And there have been some, you know, developments in the litigation history in that case.
Right. So in season one, we talked about this case. It arose after the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference adopted a policy that permitted Connecticut high school students to participate on athletic teams consistent with their gender identity established in their school records. And so during the 2017, 18, and 19 track seasons, the plaintiffs, which are cisgender females, competed in sponsored events against two transgender female athletes who are interveners in the case. And then in some, but not all races, interveners finished ahead of plaintiffs. So the plaintiffs were seeking monetary damages from the athletic conference and its member school districts and an injunction requiring them to alter the athletic records by removing the times and places of the transgender athletes and re-ranking the titles and the placements. Where we left off was a three-judge panel for the appeals for the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit affirmed the district court's decision to dismiss plaintiff's complaint, holding that the plaintiffs lack standing and that the plaintiff's claim for monetary damages are barred. They did not reach the merits of the case, but did acknowledge that discrimination against transgender students violates Title IX.
So what is the update? And this actually happened kind of right around the time that I finished the last episode, but the opinion was not yet available.
So on December 15th of 2023, the Second Circuit issued an en banc opinion. And so en banc review is something where it's a special procedure where all judges of a particular court hear the case. And these decisions are rare and generally used when the court believes that the matters are especially complex or important. And then importantly, the court still did not reach the merits of this case. Instead, they focused on two remaining issues. The first was standing, and the court here holds that the plaintiffs do have standing because they have suffered an injury in fact, and that injury is redressable by monetary damages and injunctive relief. So an important limit of that was that the plaintiffs do not have standing to seek remedies for the generalized grievances about the policy in general, and that the plaintiff's standing to seek injunctive relief ordering defendants to alter the athletic records is limited only on public records, not the private ones. And third, and most importantly, the court expressed no view at all as to whether the requested relief would be fair or even appropriate in this case. So then the second issue was about the monetary damages being barred under the Pennhurst case. And then the court ruled in that the district court must reach the merits before or in tandem with the question of notice. So it remains open whether monetary damages are barred. And then overall, the entire opinion of the district court is vacated and the case was remanded back to the district court. So basically start over.
Right. And I think that's really, I think that it's significant to talk about what this means legally and what it doesn't mean. So as you said, when reaching this decision, it really was based on the court's assessment that the case should have been allowed to move forward, but not necessarily that what was being claimed by the plaintiffs was in fact legally valid, right? Or an argument that ultimately the Second Circuit would be persuaded by. It was just that they made a claim that should be allowed to have continued.
Right. And the decision really emphasized that while the plaintiffs have standing, the same would be true if the parties were reversed. So, for example, the same would be true for the interveners. They have an ongoing interest in the litigation against any alteration of their public records. So that's another important takeaway as well, that it's not just that this is a victory for the plaintiffs or the interveners. It's kind of reverting back and taking a step back and redoing it entirely. So there's no kind of indication whether this was a positive for both sides.
Right, even though both did kind of tout it as a victory. So the original judges who heard the case, where did they fall in this en banc decision?
So two judges on the original panel, Judge Chin and Judge Carney, became the dissenting judges, while the third judge, Judge Robinson, joined the majority as to the standing issue and joined the dissent as part of the notice issue. This case had a lot of different opinions. It spanned over 142 pages, again, without even reaching the merits. And so there was a lot of different divides. There was a lot of different nuances among the concurring opinions and the concurrences in the dissents. And so again, without ever reaching the merits.
And the notice issue, again, was whether or not the school district knew or could have known that an allegation that Title IX was being violated, not the school board in this case, the athletic conference,
right,
whether they should have known that a Title IX claim could result from the inclusion of trans athletes participating in accordance with their gender identity. So we already said that nothing was really decided on the merits. It's been remanded to, you know, the federal trial court of origin. So, you know, what can we take away from this? How is it significant? Because it kind of seems on the surface like, you know, 6 years of litigation down the drain.
Right. I think we can take away a couple things. I think that, again, like we've said a couple times already, that not deciding the merits is pretty significant. And it's the decision that's repeated over and over. I think that the divide among the court is significant because there's eight different opinions. And the majority opinion stresses that the splintered nature of the court's opinion should not in any way suggest in it that its holding encompasses a determination on that highly contested underlying merits question. So they are over and over emphasizing that they are not reaching the merits. And again, I think that by not determining the merits, by not determining which side was right or wrong, that emphasis that the interveners themselves also would have claims, I think, is pretty significant and something to take away. And then there was one other thing that kind of ties into the proposed rules with Title IX is the discussion of Bostic. And for background, in Bostic, the court interpreted Title VII's identical prohibition of discrimination on the basis of sex as prohibiting discrimination against trans people and a couple other things. And then there's a discussion of whether Bostic could ever apply. And it's kind of an argument that we're going to see again when we start talking about the Title IX regulations. So I think that analysis of Bostic is also important from this decision. And then I think the other takeaway is just that refusing to hear the merits, a lot of this is speculation, but I think the court wants to be careful. It implicates a lot of different things, and the merits will determine even more. And Judge Nathan, who delivered the majority opinion, also wrote a separate concurring opinion that states that the merit issues includes considering the meaning of the word sex as contained in Title IX, implementing regulations and policy interpretations, and then it will also include considerations under those authorities of what constitutes denial of equal opportunity. So should the district court reach the question of injunctive relief, it will have to consider how to balance the principles of fairness and equality.
Yeah, but as you point out, the concern, I think, is that shutting down the claim, not even allowing the arguments to be made, I think the Second Circuit is saying, could have potential, you know, negative consequences sort of on the other side, for the other side as well. Right. And that, you know, in the interest of justice, this case should be heard on the merits. And, you know, while it's obviously now farther off, you know, all of this does suggest that, like, eventually some of these issues may or will probably make it to the Supreme Court. How soon? Hard to say. Yeah. It's, again, kind of starting over. But it's marching in that direction.
So I think that the lack of real resolution to the Seoul case kind of segues into the delayed Department of Education proposed rule on the athletic proposal, which is expected to provide a framework for schools to include or exclude transgender students from athletic teams aligning with their gender identity. And that the update to that is that there really is no update. The regulation was delayed once again in July of 2024. And the Department of Ed has repeatedly said that the delay is due to the high volume of feedback received during public comment period, but they have made sure to deny claims that the rule is being delayed because it was an election year. Now that the election has happened and passed, because of the administration change, this rule is pretty much, as you said, kind of dead in the water, and that it's unlikely to see the light of day. And, you know, there could be in the future, but then again, they would be kind of starting over from scratch. So that's kind of where we're at with that rule. And yeah, I don't know if you wanted to add anything about that specifically.
Unfortunately, for the next 4 years, at least, trans athletes who wish to play scholastic sports are in many, many states not going to be able to. And it's right. Really, you know, it makes me very sad. And, you know, I when I started researching for season one, there was that promise that the proposed rulemaking would make these sort of baseless state bans on participation, transport participation, it would at least prevent those from really taking effect. But now they will move forward, right? And the implications of that, I think we'll probably start to, well, we are already starting to see them at the collegiate level. And I think that we will start to see them in the K through 12 space as well. We wanted to talk about the other Title IX amendments, which I think you can characterize as sort of the broader or more general Title IX amendments that were published at the end of April 2024.
Right. So the final rule provided clarity regarding the definition of sex-based harassment, the scope of sex-based discrimination, including schools' obligations not to discriminate based on sex stereotypes, sex characteristics, pregnancy or other related conditions, sexual orientation and gender identity, and the school's obligations to provide an educational environment free from discrimination on the basis of sex. However, there was massive, massive pushback on this relatively simple but important update, and several states filed suit. And as of now, the Department of Education is currently enjoined from enforcing the final rule in 26 states and currently enjoined from enforcing the rule in a lot of different schools, specifically because of some of the plaintiffs in one or more of the four cases. And that actually includes Seton Hall, that includes my elementary school, I mean, not my elementary school, excuse me, my high school. And so there's hundreds of schools on this list, even if the state themselves isn't a part of the litigation that is impacted by these injunctions. And so the states that filed suit, there was common issues in a lot of them. There was a lot of discussion on the definition of the word sex in the Title IX rule, just as it stands right now, and how the final rule interferes or is not aligned with the actual statute itself. And then there was some First Amendment concerns, the spending clause concerns. There was an argument that the final rule was arbitrary and capricious. There were state sovereignty concerns. And then Texas kind of went in a little bit of a different direction as well. So, but the three cases were pretty much the same on the First Amendment, the spending clause, the arbitrary and capricious standard, and the that it violates Title IX itself.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that. The simplest way to summarize that argument is that these courts, beginning with the Western District of Louisiana, said nothing in the text or history of Title IX indicated that this law was meant to apply to anyone other than biological men or women. Right. And that is, you know, really echoed by the other courts. As far as the First Amendment argument, that was really more about what would constitute harassment. And there was concern about, you know, the rule being too broad and too vague, and that it would chill protected speech under the First Amendment. And then you did mention that there was some discussion of Bostock and whether Bostock was applicable in Title IX contexts, which these courts pretty uniformly said no, right? That Bostock applied to, was a ruling that applied to Title VII only and not in the educational context.
Right.
So one of the other issues, though, that I thought was kind of interesting, because it in a way is new, right? Not a new, not new in this particular context, but newer in sort of jurisprudence, is the major questions doctrine, which came up in three of these cases, or three of these orders granting preliminary injunctions, where basically the court said that the agency had gone too far, or that the DOE had gone too far in rulemaking that was of vast economic and political significance, but didn't appropriately have congressional authorization to do that. And this is a doctrine that has really kind of come from our current U.S. Supreme Court in recent years, and it has not really previously been a part of the discussion of this or other rulemaking cases. It really kind of originated in 2023. So, you know, that raises some pretty significant concerns about, well, we don't need to get into like all the details here, but, you know, what legal scholars have suggested might be the implication of this is that it really hinders, or could be applied in a way that hinders, the agency's ability to really make any significant rules or rule changes without congressional authorization, which kind of defeats the purpose of having an administrative state who is really by design intended to interpret or and apply broad congressional authorization in a way that allows them to efficiently make rules in their particular area of expertise. And it's kind of troubling here, because what it really sounds like is that it is going to take Congress creating a definition of sex that encompasses gender identity in order for any rulemaking to be held to be within the, you know, DOE's authority. One of the issues that came up in these opinions granting injunctive relief that I was so like very, very surprised to see. I don't know, again, why I was so surprised to see it, but this discussion again of the implications of allowing biological males into women, girls' bathrooms and locker rooms.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what that sort of argument was?
So it when it was talked about the arbitrary and capricious standards, this was especially talked about in the District of Kansas's case, where one of the plaintiffs, which was a student, kind of stated in their affidavit that they avoided using school restrooms, and that biological males who do not even identify as females went into the female restrooms because they knew that they would get away with it and wanted to go into the female restrooms. And so it's kind of like bringing back these old, already dispelled kind of almost myths or just exaggerations, where it's kind of making an issue that doesn't exist.
Yeah. I mean, listen, when I started this season one of the podcast, I really felt like socially we had moved beyond the bathroom issue, right? Yeah. And it seemed that politically we'd moved even beyond the bathroom issue. Like polling indicated that that was not a concern of most Americans, like trans kids using bathrooms according to gender identity. And now it seems, right, that like everything that Gavin Grimm fought to accomplish through the courts, through the justice system, has sort of just been forgotten or thrown away. And for those who maybe don't remember, Gavin Grimm was a transgender boy who sought the right to use his school bathrooms according to his gender identity. And he, well, he graduated before the case was final. But ultimately, the Fourth Circuit held that there that the school board's ban on, you know, allowing students to use bathrooms in accordance with their gender identity was, you know, really not substantially related to their stated interest of protecting student privacy, that there really was no real, there was really no privacy risk to students of a transgender student using the bathroom of their choosing. And that it violated Gavin's, you know, equal protection rights. But here we are, like, we're back here again, and it's, right. It's really, really disappointing that, you know, these legal issues that seemed to be settled and have progressed in a positive way have like very quickly, it seems, been sort of forgotten. Do you have any, you know, like final or additional thoughts about, you know, where we are with the final rule? I mean, obviously, multiple states will not be implementing it, and many more schools, even in states where the rule itself can be implemented, are enjoined from implementing it.
Right. So it's the list of schools both at the both at the elementary, high school level, plus the universities themselves that are currently enjoined, is the document is 263 pages long. Like, there is an incredible amount of schools in all 50 states that are implicated in this, in these injunctions. So I think that while it's technically finalized and it is an actual rule, the likelihood of it actually being enforced, or because right now it's already banned like outright in 26 states, and then with the addition of all the other schools that are implicated, there's not much that this rule is going to be able to protect. And I think that the insane amount of backlash, whether it be from the actual states, advocacy groups, or just the general public, I think really illustrates both the homophobia and transphobia that's still running rampant across the country. And I think that this behavior is exemplified by the treatment of Iman Khalif during the 2024 Olympics. Iman Khalif is an Algerian boxer who won gold at the Paris Olympics. And before winning gold, she was subject to widespread media attention after her Italian competitor withdrew from the match seconds after it began. Scrutiny over her gender and eligibility to compete caused misinformation to spread across the world. And Khalif was subject to online bullying from prominent public figures, including Elon Musk, J.K. Rowling, Piers Morgan, and even former and now current president-elect Donald Trump. The Boston Globe even mistakenly published a headline in print referring to her as a transgender boxer. They later apologized. None of the other public figures really apologized, unsurprisingly. And even on Fox News, they were calling her and another boxer biologically men on air.
Yeah, and just to say it again for anybody who maybe missed it, Iman Khalif is not trans. Iman Khalif has identified as a girl since birth. And, you know, again, without going into it, there are a lot of questions that should be asked and should be raised about the province of sort of the gender challenge to which she was subjected in another competition prior to the Olympics. That is sort of the origin of this lie that she is transgender. So, you know, I found this issue to really exemplify something that I really tried to highlight in season one of the podcast, which is that this entire debate and conversation about the inclusion of trans athletes negatively impacts, contrary to what many would like to say, really has a negative impact on cisgender female athletes as well. Because, you know, Iman was subjected to something that I don't really, do we know where this term came from? Or just, has it just sort of like organically appeared, but to transvestigation.
Right. And transvestigation is an unfounded conspiracy theory that tries to prove that notable people, typically prominent female figures, especially athletes, are secretly trans. And Laurel Powell, a spokesperson for the Human Rights Campaign, says that this trend stems from a combination of heightened and baseless anti-trans vitriol, social media amplifying disinformation or misinformation, and people's feelings about what women or men should act and look like. So that's where it kind of comes from. I'm not sure who originally coined the term.
Yeah.
But Iman Khalid was definitely subjected to this transvestigation. I mean, news outlets, social media stars, and the general public all participated. And even after there was quote unquote proof, people doubled down and continued to spread misinformation. Apologies from some outlets and others. I think like Logan Paul, for example, apologized, but obviously this did little to nothing to stop the ongoing visceral hatred.
Yeah. And so a lot of this comes from, and I think this is true in Iman Khalif's case, from this belief, and whether it's a conscious or an unconscious belief, that women athletes can't be as good as some of them are, right? And that's typically when it arises, right? When a woman athlete is exceptional, right, and dominating, this tends to be the result. And really, it's very troubling that those kind of advocating on the other side against trans athletes who are female athletes don't see this as, you know, sort of their problem. And, you know, what would you say like the effect of transvestigation is?
Yeah, so the effect of it is that the unjust treatment of trans people, as well as harmful gender stereotypes, are just perpetuated again and again. Even when attacks regarding transgender people are pointed towards cisgender individuals, the rhetoric still amplifies hate speech and exclusionary beliefs. So that's how it impacts everyone, no matter what.
Yeah, so Iman justified, like, rightfully did win a gold medal. But as you said, many of the public figures and media outlets that perpetuated this misinformation have not retracted their statements or apologized. So what recourse is there for someone to whom this has happened?
So in Iman Khalif's case, she actually filed a criminal complaint for acts of aggravated cyber harassment, and J.K. Rowling and Elon Musk were both named in the criminal complaint, and the Paris Prosecutor's Office for the Fight Against Crimes Against Humanity and Hate Crimes is conducting an investigation into charges of cyber harassment based on gender, public insults based on gender, public incitement to discrimination, and public insults on the basis of origin. And that's kind of because France specifically has a robust anti-cyberbullying laws, and that harassment via the internet, which they term as cyber stalking, is a crime punishable by a fine or imprisonment of up to 10 years. And like that is a very significant thing. And it's unclear whether this law specifically can apply in this situation, as many of the potential defendants are not French citizens and made their posts outside of France. So the positive is that there is some sort of legal action being taken. It's kind of unclear on where it will go, but it's definitely an indication that at least in this situation, it's been taken very seriously, as it should be. As far as the U.S., whether there would be the potential to hold people accountable, it's very unlikely. First, there's no federal law against cyberbullying specifically. So there's no law like there was in, like there is in France, and that the best chance would probably be a civil defamation suit. But again, it would probably be extremely hard to be, it would be extremely hard to be successful and extremely costly. So recourse in the United States is very unlikely, but there is a potential that it would be successful in France or some other countries that have a lot more strict cyberbullying laws.
Yeah, unfortunately, the legal remedies in the U.S. for spreading disinformation or misinformation generally are just not that great currently. So, you know, the last thing that I wanted to add to this episode, the Senate Judiciary Committee recently had a hearing on sports betting. It happened last week, and I sent it to you to listen to, because even though it was not on this issue, this hearing really towards the end devolved into a referendum on trans inclusion and interscholastic sports. So, right, these two seemingly unrelated topics that I just decided to do the second season of the podcast about kind of tied back into the first season. So I just wanted to, like, you know, give a little update of kind of what happened and see what your thoughts are. But it really happened because Charlie Baker, who is the current president of the NCAA, was there to talk about the impact of sports betting on collegiate athletes, which, again, I'm going to really get into in season two. But when he was questioned, I guess, by Senators Kennedy and Hawley, they took the opportunity not to talk about sports betting, which is live and legal in both their states, but they instead decided to use it as an opportunity to criticize the NCAA's approach to trans athlete inclusion. So Senator Kennedy, you know, really dug into his characterization of trans women as biological males, tried to back Baker into a corner to say that, you know, trans women will always have a physiological advantage competing in college sports against biological females, which Baker would not really concede. He didn't push back entirely. He conceded that trans women are biologically male, but said that, you know, there really wasn't a lot of research on trans athlete, you know, athletic ability compared to their cisgender peers. And, you know, Kennedy, this, we talked about this earlier, Kennedy's big quote, I think, from the hearing was he told Charlie Baker to buy a spine online and take a stand against trans college athletics, which was very quotable and popped up on many news outlets.
Right.
And then Josh Hawley really went in on the, again, the bathrooms, the locker rooms, and the showers, and referenced a recent lawsuit against the NCAA and your favorite collegiate swimmer, Riley Gaines, And also brought up this recent case involving women's college volleyball players and one coach who he said falsely had to concede games this season against San Jose State University due to allegations that one of their players is trans. Obviously, that is false because they didn't have to concede, they chose to concede. And additionally, there is actually no confirmation or denial that San Jose State even has a transgender player. And, a request to ban the athlete in question has actually recently been rejected. But, what is sort of your take on all of this as someone who participated in college sports? What was was this an issue that, came up when you were in college? Was this discussed?
So, in my own experience, it has never come up. I don't know a single out trans athlete. I think it's something that was talked a lot about in the first season, that the actual quote unquote issue is a lot smaller than what it has really been blown out of proportion, whether it's the amount, the subject matter of these, like I think it just, I talked about it a little bit earlier. It just comes from a place of fear, misinformation, misunderstanding. And like we saw in the lawsuits talking about the bathroom bans, it's just, again, it just is perpetually getting worse and worse and worse. And it's really heartbreaking to see because athletics is supposed to be for everyone. And I benefited tremendously from being an athlete, being able to participate in sports. And I wish that everybody was afforded that same opportunity because, I mean, my life would be so much different if I didn't have my sport. I wasn't allowed to compete or anything like that. Just being allowed in the space should be a no-brainer. Like, everyone should be allowed to participate. So I've always been very confused on what the big deal is, what the big issue is. I think that trans athletes should be in the sport. I think there are so many other things that can be done if you want to protect women. And I think it's just thinly veiled transphobia because these people have no idea what is actually going on. And I think that a very small percentage of athletes that truly did have an issue really blew the topic out of proportion.
Yeah.
I kind of started rambling, but
Well, and as Dick Durbin, who's the chair of the committee, kind of said as they were finishing up, he asked Charlie Baker, how many athletes are there in the NCAA? And there's over 500,000 collegiate athletes covered by the NCAA. And he asked how many of them was Charlie Baker aware of that were transgender, and he said less than 10. Right.
Right.
So the idea and the narrative that trans women are stealing opportunities from cisgender women is just, as you said, completely overblown. And in fact, it actually may be the fear of trans people and the subsequent roadblocks to potentially beneficial and impactful rulemaking, like the general Title IX rule that hurts women the most, right? Because as we talked about, those Title IX rules that now are can't be implemented in not in part, right? They can't implement the rules in part. So all the revised Title IX rules that protect women from discrimination on the basis of pregnancy or you know, improve adjudication of sexual harassment claims, right? Now women don't have those protections because of a fear of, you know, a very small number of trans athletes who really just want not to dominate, not to take away like the glory of cisgender women, but just want to be able to do a thing that they love.
Right.
And so, you know, I guess that's kind of a downer note to end this update on, but I think, you know, what we have seen in the last year since I finished recording season one is that this has continued, that this issue of transgender inclusion in interscholastic sport has continued to be a huge issue, both politically and socially. And we will probably see it continue to be a major legal issue as well. So it's probably one that we will be revisiting. Well, thank you for spending your precious winter break doing both the research for this update and also having this conversation. So I look forward to seeing you when you come back to school in January.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Hearsay from the Sidelines is a collaboration of Seton Hall Law School and Culture and Sports. This episode was researched and written by Emily Radish with some contributions from me, Sarah Grass. Music by Supernova, produced by Sarah Grass and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki, Executive Director of Culture and Sports. Links to all available academic and primary legal sources, media, music, transcription, and other materials mentioned in this episode are available on the Hearsay from the Sidelines show page at hearsayfromthesidelines.com. And if you like this show, check out cultureandsports.com, where you'll find more articles, shows, webinars, summits, and courses for sports leaders of all levels.